If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
During this difficult time, we want to make it as easy as possible for our readers to get their copy of BBC History Magazine or BBC History Revealed. So for the next few months, we'll deliver your favourite magazine direct to your door with no delivery charge. From today, you can save up to 70% off the shop price and subscribe from just £9.99. That's just £1.66 per issue. There's never been a better time to get your favourite history magazine delivered direct to your home. To take advantage of this unmissable offer, please visit buysubscriptions.com/History Extra and choose your magazine. Don't forget, all of our magazines are also available digitally on your mobile or tablet device. Visit buysubscriptions.com/History Extra for more information. We look forward to welcoming you. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Later this year, a few months after its original release date, the latest instalment of the James Bond franchise, No Time to Die, is set to be released in cinemas. On today's episode, we'll hear from the author Henry Hemming, who explored the real-life inspirations behind the lead characters in Fleming's spy series in the April issue of BBC History Magazine. Ahead of the announcement that the film would be delayed, he met up with our deputy digital editor, Eleanor Evans, to talk about the staggering success of The Fictional Spy.
Well, thanks so much for joining us again on the History Extra podcast.
Pleasure.
So you've joined us before talking about some real-life spies, real-life spy masters. Mm. Today we're talking about probably the world's most famous spy, but one who's fictional. So could we start by perhaps looking at Ian Fleming's James Bond? When did he first come onto the scene?
So the first James Bond book was written in 1952, and it's been written about a lot, but Ian Fleming went for a swim by Goldeneye, his house in Jamaica, and then sat down in front of a battered Royale typewriter and began to write. And he almost didn't stop for the next 2 weeks. 2 weeks later, he had Casino Royale finished. And that's the rest is history, you could say. The success was, I think it surprised him as much as anyone else. He didn't think it would do quite as well as it did. But the success is phenomenal. I mean, the film franchise has generated $7 billion to date. And I think until very recently, it was the largest film franchise in history. More than 100 million copies of the books have been sold worldwide, and they continue to sell like hotcakes. And I mean, I think as someone who writes about spies, it's fascinating to try and work out what it is about this particular spy, because there are lots of other spies who've been invented or real spies have been written about, but this is the one who endures more than anyone else. And the thing that also intrigues me about this, I remember having a conversation once with a retired intelligence officer who was talking about what it meant to work in British intelligence during the late 20th century. And he was saying that, funny enough, two people who made a big difference to his work were two people who never existed, Smiley and Bond. And I was really intrigued by this. So he says Smiley was important because the success of Smiley made a prospective agent imagine that this spy master, i.e. the person I was talking to, had hidden depths. And even when he was just lost for thought, he was probably having an emotional response to something in his mind, that he had a hinterland, that there was more going on than might otherwise be the case. But he talked about Bond as obviously being someone who made the idea of being a spy more attractive, because he presents a very glamorous, fictionalized version of the reality of espionage. And for a lot of people, that adds to the romance and the glamour.
Mm-hmm. And I think Ian Fleming is almost just as fascinating as Bond. As you say, the success is staggering. How did his life inform this character?
I mean, a lot of it is wish fulfillment. I mean, it's not autobiographical. Bond, when he shares certain characteristics with Fleming, they look reasonably similar. They both went to Eton for a bit. They both lost their fathers early on in life. They both were acting commanders in the Royal Naval Reserve. But at the same time, Fleming himself was not a man of action in the way that Bond emphatically is. And you get a sense of, I mean, during the war, Fleming was mostly behind a desk, and he was involved in setting up and helping to run one particular commander unit, 30 Assault Unit. And it was the people he met there who played a large part in inspiring this character, James Bond. And you can imagine part of him wanted to be doing that, wanted to be out in the field, but I think also recognised that that wasn't him. He wasn't good enough. And he's very honest about this in all the interviews he gives after the success of Bond becomes evident, saying that, you know, this is someone who I don't really like, this Bond character, but he's part of me, wants to be part of him, if that makes sense. But the thing I found really interesting writing this piece about Bond was understanding just the lengths Fleming goes to not pin this character down. He doesn't tell you too much. And John le Carré calls him the ultimate prostitute, Bond, not Fleming, in the sense you can project onto him what you want to find there. And I mean, every detail there suggests this, even the name James Bond does not immediately place him socially. That could come from anywhere. It's not James Quillington Smythe or something like that. And even his hobbies and interests, you don't hear about James Bond going off hunting, shooting, fishing. He's into fast cars, he's into gambling. These are all tastes that you can acquire. So anyone can imagine themselves to be Bond. And I think that's why you have this fascinating thing whereby the character is such a part of British national identity that the choice of the actor who's going to play him becomes a subject of nationwide debate, which you just don't get with any other imaginary character, which tells you about just, I mean, how kind of rooted he is in the way we see ourselves as people living in Britain, but also the extent to which you need to basically to see something of yourself in this character. And if you feel the actor doesn't do that, then you say so.
Mm-hmm. If we do go to the man himself, then you already talked about how Ian Fleming's the parallels made with Fleming might be somewhat wish-fulfilling. But if we look at some real-life figures who may have inspired Bond, who do you think is on that list?
So one of them is someone I've written about a lot in my last book, Our Man in New York, and that's Bill Stevenson, who was someone Fleming was impressed by and who worked under briefly during the Second World War when he went out to America. Stevenson was the MI6 head of station in New York. And there was something about him that Fleming was intrigued by. And he made lots of notes about exactly what he did and said. He even noted down how Stevenson liked to make his martini, which was shaken, not stirred, which is the birth of that particular detail. And Fleming later said Stevenson is not so much Bond, because Bond is an imaginary figure. Stevenson is the real thing. But he was part of it. Some of the other characters include his brother, Peter Fleming, who was a dashing man of action. Somebody called Patrick, I don't know how to say this, but Dalzell Job. It might be one of these funny names where it's sort of Dalil or who knows. Also have Conrad O'Brien for French. And that's not a stutter I've developed. That is spelt like that. Two Fs at the beginning of French. Again, that takes us back to this idea. That's very much not the kind of name he wanted Bond to actually have. But this was someone who was a commando figure, who was fearless, who was tough, who was known for his exploits during the war. And these are the kinds of people who inspired Fleming. I mean, he described Bond as being a blunt instrument in the hands of the government, someone who would follow orders and was quite tough, quite almost thuggish. And a lot of these characters had elements of that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the name. You've mentioned it a couple of times. It being so able to project any identity you want. Can we talk about where that came from?
Yeah. So the actual name James Bond, we think, I mean, Fleming told various stories about exactly where it came from. But one of them was that it comes from the American ornithologist James Bond, who wrote A Field Guide to Birds of the West Indies, I think it's called. And Ian Fleming was a keen bird watcher himself, as well as someone who loved being in what was known as the West Indies. And so he knew this book, he knew this name, it obviously resonated with him in some way. But at the same time, there's no actual similarity between the character of this ornithologist and James Bond himself. I mean, the one small sort of inside joke, perhaps, is that at some point in the mid-20th century, the name birdwatcher was slang for spy within the world of intelligence. So maybe that was Fleming sort of, trying to make a joke that others in his world would understand.
Right. A little nod, perhaps.
Yeah.
So before we go back, perhaps, to Ian Fleming and a bit more about his career, your piece in BBC History magazine, your recent piece, looks as well at the iconic cast that also has come to represent so much of the Bond franchise, Miss Moneypenny or the villains. Can we talk about some of the parallels you found with the real people who would have inspired the people around Bond?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the first character to talk about is M, the iconic M, Bond's spy master, who, I mean, originally when you go into it, it's pretty clear that the main inspiration is Fleming's boss during the Second World War, Admiral John Godfrey, who was in naval intelligence. And Fleming was his aide for 2 years. But Godfrey was never known as M. And where it becomes more interesting is why Fleming chose this particular letter of the alphabet. So James Bond's nominal boss would have been a guy called C, the head of SIS. And at the same time, he didn't want to reveal too much about SIS, so he chose a different letter. Why did he go for M? There was Colonel Gubbins, a guy in SOE, who occasionally signed off some of his letters as M. But someone else who I know a certain amount about because I've written about him in one of my other books, Maxwell Knight, was also known as M. And he, I would argue, was the best known M in the secret world at that time. He'd spent 30 years running M section. All of his agents were called MA, MB, MC, and so on. And so he, I imagine, helped to inspire this choice of the letter M. But then there's one other person who may have inspired it, and that's Ian Fleming's mother, who signed her letters M, was known to her children as M, but also fulfilled an almost similar role to M as to James Bond in terms of how she was with Ian Fleming himself. So during the 1930s, Ian Fleming was bouncing between different jobs and schools and institutions. But most of these moves were engineered by his mother, who doted upon him. He was the much-loved second son in the family. And you can almost imagine him going in to see her every couple of years as this sort of new departure began to find out what his next mission would be, where he was going to, whether he was going to Switzerland, whether it's going to Moscow or what have you. And so I think there is a nice parallel there. So I think his mother certainly played a part in inspiring the name M. You've talked about Miss Moneypenny. There are a couple of candidates there, but there's no sort of obvious candidate. And I think in terms of the style of that relationship, it's a very innuendo-heavy, flirtatious. All the evidence suggests Fleming just did not have that with the people who are meant to have inspired Moneypenny. There's also Q, and there is a real person who ran something called Q Branch and was called Charles Fraser Smith. And he, during the Second World War, ran this department which invented incredible gadgets that people working for SOE or commando units, such as the one Fleming was involved in, would go to get these gadgets before they went into occupied Europe. And usually these were everyday objects that had some kind of weapon or tool hidden inside them, such as invisible inks. There was garlic-flavoured chocolate for British agents heading to France, which I have all sorts of problems with. This was to try and make them blend in with the local population. I mean, this suggests that French people were sort of eating garlic non-stop, which I don't think they were at the time. But also, garlic-flavoured chocolate, that's never going to work. Another one, which I read about, and again I've got problems with, is the a shoestring that was also a garrote. Because if you wear a garrote for a shoestring, it's not really going to work as a shoestring. Anyway, this is, legend has it, these are some of the things that the real Q branch produced. And Fleming knew all about this. He described a Q branch in the books. He didn't actually describe a Q in the books, but he was involved in helping to oversee the scripting of the films. And I'm sure he played a part in the birth of that character on screen.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
There's absolutely no ambiguity in the books about who is right and who is wrong. Bond is right and the people up against him are wrong.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Can we talk about the villains then? Because, I mean, it seems from what your article lays out that it is a bit of a case of be careful or you'll end up in my novel.
Definitely, yeah. There's, all of them pretty much have in some way annoyed Fleming and he's got his revenge. So two of them, Blofeld and Scaramanga. Legend has it that he'd known a guy called Scaramanga at school and had got into various fights with him, but that wasn't enough. It was later when his nephew, a guy called Nicol Fleming, mentioned to his uncle, and this is around the time Fleming was beginning to write, I think, the second and third Bond books, that he's being bullied. He's being bullied at school by two particular prefects. One was called Blofeld and one was called Scaramanga. And Fleming obviously decided enough was enough. He was going to get his revenge. I mean, in terms of the impact that has on those people and their descendants, there's something almost quite unfair and not wicked about it. I mean, did he know just how well the books were going to do at the time? I don't know. Maybe he thought it was fun. But, yeah, those people have lived with it every time they, I don't know, book a table at a restaurant. It's going to come up. Goldfinger, that was another one. The Bond villain Auric Goldfinger was very much inspired by Erno Goldfinger, who was the modernist architect. Ian Fleming did not like his buildings. Plenty of people in London did not. None of them had the kind of reach that Fleming did. And Goldfinger tried to take him to court. He tried to sue him, tried to halt the publication of the book. I think at one point Fleming suggested he would rename Goldfinger as Gold Prick. But the publisher thought that was just going to make things worse. And I think there was some kind of compromise where they were going to sort of downplay the name Goldfinger in the publicity. But essentially, yeah, it was unchanged. And I think Goldfinger was furious for the rest of his life about that. And I think Hugo Drax was another one who got on the wrong side of him at some point.
So if we can go back to Fleming then, you already mentioned how he perceived Bond as a man of action, whereas his realities as working within these organisations were somewhat different. Mm. Can you give us a bit of insight into what Fleming's activities would have been like? You know, what kind of operations he would have been involved in?
Yes, so a lot of the time he was coming up with ideas for his boss, Admiral John Godfrey. He was coming up with deception plans. He was thinking of ways to bamboozle the Germans. He was also involved in the creation of this commando unit that I mentioned earlier, 30 assault units or 30 AU. And this was under the aegis of naval intelligence. And this was, as the word commando suggests, it would carry out special operations. It would often go in advance of the main military force. And so that's where he encountered so many of these people who helped to inspire this James Bond character. But so a lot of it was planning and observing and writing reports and writing out papers. And also, ever so slightly, looking after this character, not quite M, but Admiral John Godfrey, who was sometimes difficult to... So he was a liaison between Godfrey and other people. So a lot of it was just quite boring communication and smoothing things over when Godfrey got cross with people.
What do you think was it about 1950s society that made this spy such a phenomenon?
Moral clarity. There's absolutely no ambiguity in the books about who is right and who is wrong. Bond is right and the people up against him are wrong. And at the same time, he's not quite infallible, but he's very good at what he does. There is a prowess. There is a success. He exudes success as well as vigour and all of these other things. And, of course, at the time, during this moment of British imperial decline, the 1950s, this is, that was what a lot of people wanted to read. But what's so intriguing is that it's a global phenomenon. It's not just people in Britain who are kind of getting off on this. It's all over the world. People are enjoying this idea. And there's something else that goes on where it's almost what other people around the world want to see of Britain and Britishness. And it sort of fills this a British stereotype that some people around the world have, a kind of flattering, glamorous stereotype, but a stereotype nonetheless. So it works in both ways. So the people within this cartoonish figure, they like it, we like it. And people outside enjoy looking at it. So it's a really interesting phenomenon. Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that you're a fan of the James Bond books, or as a historian, you use them as a...
I like them. I mean, if I was sitting down tonight and I wanted to read a book about spies, I'd probably turn to a Le Carré book if I could just choose one on a whim. I adore almost everything that Le Carré has written, certainly early Le Carré. So, I mean, I like Ian Fleming and I enjoy the complexity of Le Carré a tiny bit more. But also, I love... What I like about the Fleming books is that they do precisely what they set out to do, and they achieve it successfully. I think the worst way to criticise something is to criticise it for not doing something it never tried to do. And I think he perfectly executes what he's tried to do.
Mm-hmm. Reading it with your historian's hat on, it's perhaps... Is it a little bit confronting, or is it you just saying, no, it's designed to entertain?
It's designed to entertain. I mean... Yeah, there are, from a historian's point of view, I think there's plenty to pick up on. I think it's, maybe the best thing you can say about it from a historical point of view is that having someone like Fleming who'd lived through the Second World War, who'd lived through the world of intelligence, who sort of was frustrated in some ways by what he had and hadn't done and by the sometimes sort of complex nature of what he was doing, this was the opposite. This is where everything was clear and certain. And I think if anything, it tells you about what it was like to live in that world where you long for it to be clear and certain, for the enemies just to be baddies and your agent to do all the right things all the time.
Mm. So if that moral certainty is more clear, and certainly the earlier, when he first came on the scene, I think it's probably fair to say that later depictions of Bond have maybe been a bit more morally ambiguous.
Yes.
What do you think Why do you think that change had to come about, or did it? And why do you think that kind of still fuels this real fascination with him today? Why movies are still being made?
I think you're absolutely right, because they've taken on board some of the things that happen in the world of how he writes about spies. And I think Le Carré plays a big part in that. And many people have written about this, how Le Carré changes the genre by introducing a more ambiguous sense of what's right and what's wrong. And what I love about more recent films is they really embrace that. I mean, Casino Royale, the film, was fantastic. That's one of my favourite films. And because you do get a sense of this uncertainty, and you know, any film that that really grips you and absolutely, yeah, entertains you is one in which the central character has some kind of flaw, something they have to get over. And I think the more recent films definitely get that. And hopefully the new one will as well.
That was Henry Hemming. Henry is the author of 6 non-fiction books, including Our Man in New York, which was published by Quercus in the UK and is available now. You can also listen to Henry discuss the real spy masters, Bill Stevenson and Maxwell Knight, on 2 previous episodes of the History Extra podcast. You can find both at historyextra.com/podcast. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us next on Wednesday when Linda Porter will be discussing The Mistresses of Charles II.